Welcome to The Reason Rundown, the podcast to end your week, where we unpack a single big story with a single reason journalist. I'm Peter Suderman. Last week, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and with it, the constitutional right to abortion that had existed since 1973. This was a major moment in constitutional history. But for millions of American women, the decision will also have significant personal ramifications. The end of Roe doesn't make abortion illegal, but it sets in motion some complex legal changes. Abortion will be legal in some states and prohibited in others. Other states will restrict abortion after a certain point in pregnancy. Meanwhile, courts may intervene to block some state laws, as has already happened in Louisiana and Utah. And prosecutors in some places may decline to pursue abortion-related cases. Then there's medication abortion. Last year, the Food and Drug Administration authorized medication abortion to be prescribed with an online consultation for women up to 10 weeks pregnant. The pills can be sent through the mail. The Biden administration has vowed to fight states that attempt to outlaw medication abortion.
My administration will also protect a woman's access to medications that are approved by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Mifepristone, which the FDA approved 20 years ago.
Even if the Biden administration's efforts fail, a black market for illegal abortions seems likely to arise. And looming behind all of this is the threat of jail or prison time for women who seek abortions, or potentially even for women who experience miscarriages. In short, obtaining an abortion has suddenly become a legal labyrinth, subject to the whims of courts and law enforcement officials.
Maybe there'll be some little something there that a woman can work with, a person can work with who wants to have an abortion.
Today, I'm going to be talking with Reason senior editor Elizabeth Nolan Brown about the future of abortion after Roe, the legal mess, the impact on women, and what sort of responses we're likely to see, legal and otherwise. Liz, you've been writing about women's rights for Reason for a long time. You're also a co-founder of Feminists for Liberty. So this is something I know you've been following closely. Give us the short version. In practical terms, what does the Supreme Court's decision mean for women who might want to seek an abortion?
Unfortunately, there is no quick answer to that because I don't think anyone knows right now. It's kind of a big mess at the moment.
I mean, in some ways, that is the quick answer, right?
Yeah. The quick answer, yes, is that it's a mess and no one knows. As some small examples, like some abortion clinics in states that, just to back up for one second, some states had trigger laws on the books saying that, abortion was as soon as Roe was overturned, abortion would become illegal. Other states had laws on the books that were 100 or more years old that made abortion a crime. And they just weren't being enforced. And still other states had passed new laws that the courts had said, no, you can't do this because it's unconstitutional. So then as soon as the Supreme Court's decision came down, they asked, like, hey, can we enforce it now? And people were like, yes. Like, Ohio is one of those states where immediately the attorney general went to a court and was like, can we enforce our 6-week ban now? And they were like, yeah. So, immediately a lot of clinics have shut down as they're waiting to see what is happening. But in other places, courts have put, a stay on these laws. Like in Louisiana, which was going to start enforcing a law criminalizing abortion, a court said, no, you have to wait for the moment. So it's really just sort of left this gray area where nobody knows exactly what is legal and what is not in some of these states. I even saw a doctor of emergency medicine talking about how, Ohio's law does not have an exception for fatal birth defects. So, even if a fetus is going to die as soon as it is born, they can't do an abortion. So that was one thing he was used to doing. So he's like, now, like, it was as soon as the law changed, he was like, crap, like I had patients that were coming in for stuff like that. Like, what do I do? It's all very up in the air.
Okay, so it's a mess. But we can say that abortion is going to be almost entirely illegal in some number of states.
Yes.
And illegal in certain condition under certain conditions in others. And illegal means criminal punishment. It means people going to jail. So talk me through this. What do we know right now about enforcement of the new regime? What do you expect to happen? And what do you fear will happen? What is the worst case scenario?
I think that for now, for the early days, we are not going to see laws enacted against women who get abortions, even though there are some of those. I think Louisiana was one that was you know, said that that could happen. For the most part, though, people are passing laws or that are would enforce them against abortion doctors or people who prescribe abortion pills, or in some cases like Texas and Oklahoma, people who aid and abet abortions. So it's not, it is a kind of broad category. And I think that that's one very worrying thing, this new trend towards, you know, criminalizing people who aid and abet abortions. I was just reading.
So that could mean people who help a woman travel out of state to get an abortion in a place where it is legal, right?
It could also mean, we don't really know what it would mean, but it could mean a lot of very broad things too, because like National Right to Life just put out their model legislation and it goes on about how people who aid and abet abortion could be anyone who counsels anyone via telephone or the internet about how to get an abortion. So that could be like, you know, if you told someone, well, you can go to this website and they'll mail you abortion pills, like, and your state had criminalized abortion, just telling someone that could, people want to make that illegal at least. You could also
see
websites.
So could that theoretically include flyers or publishing information online? Doesn't that raise free speech issues?
Yes, it does. It raises huge free speech issues. This is actually something I wrote about for Reason last week, just before the Supreme Court decision came down, that before Roe v. Wade and a subsequent case in 1975 that said abortion advertising could not be criminalized, abortion advertising was criminalized in a lot of states. And that didn't just mean ads for abortion or ads for abortion services in other states. There was a lot of debate about what exactly it meant, but there was, you know, some pastors that counseled women in their parish about how to travel to another state to get an abortion, and they were arrested. There were, you know, editorials about this that were in papers, and people would, you know, weren't sure if that was okay. So there was just like a huge amount of speech that was caught up in these abortion bans, and it got litigated, and I think we're going to see that again.
So it seems like there are going to be a lot of, maybe not unintended consequences, but indirect consequences, ripple effects. Roe was obviously specifically about abortion, but there are fears that this will impact some forms of contraception as well. For example, there's already been a run, reportedly, on Plan B, also known as the morning after pill. Apparently, women are stocking up on this right now. Do you think there is reason to fear that the Supreme Court's decision last week will lead to bans on contraception or regulations that go beyond abortion restrictions?
So, yeah, yes, I think people will attempt that. You know, Plan B, emergency contraception, it can prevent fertilized eggs from implanting under various laws, including this model legislation that Right to Life is trying to get states to pass. You know, it would say that personhood starts at fertilization. So therefore, Plan B could be considered a form of abortion. Whether or not that will like fly in the courts, I don't know. But I definitely think that there will be some states that want to try to get rid of it. And also just real quick to go back to your previous question. I do think that states will try to criminalize women, even if it's not directly under abortion statutes. We've already seen, you know, in some cases, like women get charged for feticide or child endangerment for things like taking drugs during pregnancy or, you know, doing anything. There was one case where a woman got into a fight with someone. She initiated the fight and she ended up miscarrying and they charged her because they said, you know, she had caused the death of her child. So I think that this will open up for more of that, even if women aren't directly criminalized under these abortion statutes right now.
So that's a byproduct of fetal personhood laws, potentially. If you say that a fetus is legally a person, then in theory, a woman could be charged for, say, child abuse if she did drugs or drank. And this is a potential indirect consequence of the Supreme Court overturning Roe. So one thing I wanted to ask you about is just one of the consistent themes of your work at Reason, which is that prohibition efforts meant to stamp out disfavored behavior often end up harming the people they're supposed to help. This is particularly true when it comes to sex work and sex workers. But I wonder if you think there is a similar dynamic here with abortion. I suppose what I'm asking is, the pro-life movement bills itself as pro-woman in many ways, and as helping pregnant women and expectant mothers. And their argument is this should make life better for them. Do you think that that is going to be universally true, sometimes true?
I think that that is not at all true because, you know, if you are an expectant mother and you don't want to be, being forced to be an expectant mother and then become a mother is not going to make anyone's life better. Obviously, it will make people's lives harder. And just to say, you know, I think this is something that people find kind of perverse to say because people will be like, well, you're better being born than not being born. But like, if you're not in existence yet, if you are just, you know, a 5-week-old fetus, like you don't know that you're not going to be born. And some of those children that do end up born because of this might have really, really tough lives. They might have parents who are not going to take care of them in the womb or beyond, and they might end up with, you know, really horrible circumstances. And I think that it could actually be bad for both kids that are born because and weren't wanted, and then the existing children of people who maybe would have gotten abortion because they have a bunch of kids already and can't afford another one. I think it could end up bad for children too, which is exactly what, you know, it directly is supposed to help.
So let's talk about workarounds. Last year, the FDA approved medication abortion without an in-person consultation. It's basically a 2-dose abortion pill for women who are up to 10 weeks pregnant. All you have to do is contact a physician online, right, over Skype, something like that. So in theory, women in states where abortion is banned can just contact a doctor through their phone, through their computer, and get pills delivered to their house, right? Doesn't that in some ways undermine the ability of states to completely outlaw abortion?
Yes. Now, it would not be legal, you know, if Ohio banned abortion pills here and banned abortion entirely and telemedicine abortion, someone in Kentucky, say, which Kentucky would probably be even just as likely to do it, but just for the sake of argument, I'm in Ohio, so, you know, if Kentucky then a doctor there prescribed them and tried to mail them to someone in Ohio, that would not be legal. You couldn't have someone, well, theoretically, under the way states want this to work, that would not be legal. But someone could just have if they had someone in another state where it was illegal, or they went to a state and got a PO box or anything like that, they could have them mailed there. Then again, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the Biden administration is saying that they are actually going to possibly say that states cannot ban this because it's an FDA-approved drug, and therefore that preempts any states trying to ban it from being allowed. So that will be really interesting to see how that plays out.
And then there's interstate travel, which we've already talked about a little bit. But, you know, obviously some women who live in states where abortion is prohibited are going to end up traveling to states where abortion is legal to seek abortions. Some companies have even announced abortion-related travel benefits. But there are also worries that out-of-state abortion travel will end up being banned as well. Do you think there's any reason to think that women will face criminal punishment for crossing state lines to get abortions?
Again, I don't think that that's a thing that will fly in the long run. Like, I don't think that that's constitutional. For what it's worth, Brett Kavanaugh wrote in his concurring opinion that that was not constitutional and could not be a thing. But I have seen state legislatures already talking about it. And I think maybe even once they'd already introduced a bill to try and do that. So I think that in the short term, we will see people trying to make that a thing, even if it ultimately is not constitutional.
So what about black market or maybe gray market abortion services? It seems like given the murky nature of the law where abortion is going to be prohibited in at least some places and in some instances, this is going to lead to a prohibition regime. And one thing that we as libertarians always talk about is that prohibition regimes end up producing black markets of some sort. How do you see that playing out post-Roe?
I mean, especially when it comes to abortion pills, we're definitely going to see just a huge black market in that because you can get them from overseas pharmacies, overseas doctors. People could have them shipped here and no, they're not going to abide by rules saying like, oh, you can't bid them. You can't send them to this state or you can't send them to this state. And I think that opens us up to a lot of enforcement issues that are going to be kind of crazy, like war on drugs style, because you're going to have, you know, the government having to try and prevent these drugs from coming into the country illegally. You're going to have them trying to prevent people from, you know, mailing them. You know, that's another avenue where I think women will be charged if they receive them or they take them. And maybe again, that won't fall directly under abortion laws, but it'll be, you know, receiving this illegal substance or something like that. I mean, there's all sorts of ways it could play out, but I think it's definitely going to go sort of full drug war surveillance state style eventually.
You recently wrote a piece for Persuasion about how most Americans are not radicals when it comes to abortion. They are abortion moderates. I want to talk about that piece, but before we get into the abortion moderate aspect, I want to ask you, would it be fair to say that you consider yourself an abortion radical?
I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not quite sure where my own boundaries on this are. I mean, I am not someone who thinks like you should just be able to abort up until, you know, the day before a baby is born for any reason. But I also think that that's a little bit of a straw man, because as far as we know, that's not something that actually happens. And to believe that that happens, you have to believe really bad things about women, right? You have to believe that they're just like so frivolous or heartless that they're just like, oh, you know, I couldn't be bothered for 9.5 months to get an abortion, and now I'm going to, you know? From everything we know, and there's not like some national database, so I'm not saying it's never happened where people have had them after, you know, a certain amount of months for a not good reason. But the vast... 93% take place, I think, in the first trimester, and like 99% take place before the end of the second trimester. And when it comes to ones after that, it's usually because there is something severely wrong with the fetus where it is not going to live outside of the womb, or it's only going to live, you know, 2 days of agonizing misery, or because the mother's life is at risk. So I know this is a long answer to a question, but I think, you know, this is the reason why saying that bans, like, you know, that there's have to be at a cutoff at this date and there's no exceptions is bad, because there always should be some exceptions for cases like that.
So that's interesting that you frame it that way, because I do think that in some ways the abortion rights movement has at times seemed uncomfortable articulating limits on when abortion maybe should or could be restricted. I think we've seen that. Not just with sort of activists, but with Democratic politicians who increasingly seem unclear on what they're allowed to say, right? What the activist base is going to accept from them. Do you think that that unwillingness to articulate any kind of limits at all is helping the pro-choice movement or is hurting it?
No, I think it's, I understand why people are reticent, because exactly what I just said, like, it's hard to say exactly where that line should be. I think most people believe that there should be some cutoff, but like saying exactly what, where that should be and what exceptions should exist is really, really hard. But yes, the not articulating clear cutoffs is not helping people, because it allows people to portray Democrats and pro-choice activists as these extremists who are for, you know, all sorts of horrible things. You know, you hear about the like, oh, they want to, you know, they want to let take a baby out and then kill it as it's coming out of the birth canal and stuff like that, which is not true. You know, no one wants that, but it allows those sorts of accusations because people are not clearly articulating where their limits would be.
So it's difficult to describe where the limits should be, and yet you also wrote about how pro-choicers like yourself can and should talk to abortion moderates, which in your telling is that's most of the country, right? And you argued that pro-choicers should use the sentiments that abortion moderates have, right, should mobilize them in order to help make sure that abortion remains legal in many or most cases. Talk to me about how you think that people who are maybe not abortion radicals, but committed pro-choicers should be talking to that moderate American middle.
I think that they should just be focusing on, you know, stressing again and again that the vast majority of abortions take place in the first trimester, that they are very safe, that abortion is a very safe procedure for women during that time, and that, you know, a fetus is not very far developed at that time. I think that they should say, yes, of course, there should be some limits. If they can't stress where those are, they should just sort of be vague about it, but they shouldn't say, you know, they shouldn't be too vague about it, I guess. You know, they shouldn't trade. What I worry, and I hate talking about this because I know that some people think that any compromise here is a bad idea, but I worry that a push to be like, no, we need to have abortion up until this point, 15 weeks, 20 weeks, 24 weeks, whatever, to, you know, until viability, then we need to have abortion up till then. And people are going to get so hung up on that that they're going to then we're going to ban it all entirely. But if maybe if they'd say like, okay, we're only going to have first trimester abortions, maybe that would fly. I don't know. It's really complicated because I know that people say like, no, people who are think abortion is murder are not going to stop at that. And they're still going to be pushing for these laws and pushing for these laws. And that's the problem is that you have, that is a very, minority opinion, actually. Like, you know, poll after poll shows most people think abortion should be legal in at least some circumstances and up to a point. But the people that are the most extreme about it are the ones who just, you know, hammer home about it all the time and, you know, vote only on this issue and get their legislators to pass stuff like this. So it's really hard to say that it's really hard to enact moderate laws, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
So it's hard, but I guess I wonder if, let me put it this way, the end of Roe is obviously a loss for the pro-choice side, but it also restarts the conversation in some ways. And it returns, in part because it returns policy decisions to elected legislatures rather than to the courts. Do you think there is any chance that the Supreme Court's ruling might end up paving the way for a new, more stable consensus, almost in the way that prohibition, as bad as it was, helped pave the way for a kind of new consensus on alcohol legalization?
Yes, I do think that's possible. I think it's going to definitely reinvigorate the reproductive rights movement and sort of draw in people who were not, you know, who before just thought of this as not kind of a non-issue for them because it was settled. But people who are very moderately pro-choice, maybe, or, you know, just middle of the row on this, especially if some of the more extreme policies that we see Republicans and pro-choice activists or pro-life activists want to pass actually come into effect. You know, if you start seeing miscarriages be investigated, you start seeing more and more women being charged with murder or, you know, child endangerment for doing anything during pregnancy, you start seeing this huge police state come up around this, I think that people will be more and more likely to be like, okay, no, and to push back against the pro-life extremists. Whereas up till now, it's just been like, it's all been sort of theoretical. So there hasn't really been, you know, much reason for moderates on this issue to get involved or to care about it very much.
So somewhat paradoxically, you think there's a possibility that the experience of prohibition, however difficult it might end up being, could end up making the case for abortion rights.
Yes, I do think so.
Okay, that's all we have for this week. Thanks again for listening to this inaugural episode of The Reason Rundown. If you like this show, please remember to subscribe and recommend it to friends. And as always, if you like this podcast or Reason's work generally, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. I'm Peter Suderman, and this has been The Reason Rundown.